So this evening, as we all are aware, I think, it is the Maga Puja full moon occasion. And traditionally in Thailand, that's a time when it's a sort of Sangha day. The Sangha comes together, the monastic community gathers together, and sometimes in Ajahn Chah's monasteries, it means sort of coming to visit the main monastery. All the branch monasteries get together. I remember here it used to be that we used to have a two-month winter retreat rather than a three-month winter retreat back in the days when we did lots and lots and lots and lots of work. And therefore, 2 months was enough. We would start working in March. And so it worked quite well. So the Maga Puja day would be a time when the branch monasteries, Harlem and Devon and Chithurst, they'd all come together for kind of total communal gathering. Often the new monasteries in Switzerland and Italy would come together too. And we don't do that anymore for various reasons. One of the very good ones is that we have a nice long three-month retreat. And yet the spirit of it is one of community and appreciating the Kalyanamitta that we have in these communities. And the occasion, of course, itself, traditionally, in the suttas, we're told that there was a time when at the bamboo grove, I believe it was, the Buddha was there, and without making any arrangements, 1,250 Arahant disciples happened also to appear there as well. Not just out of thin air, I don't think, but they all were there with the Buddha. And he gave us a short and pithy sermon called the Awada Patimokkha, which is what's printed on these sheets we have. And it was like a summary of the teaching, which is particular to every Buddha. You know, the Buddha that we know lived in a particular time in India 2,500 years ago in a particular culture. And yet Buddhas can be, you know, any being that awakens fully over many, many lifetimes. There are many Buddhas over many, many ages. And so those cultures that a different Buddha would arise in might be quite different. And the ways that the teachings are expressed will have to do, you know, the particular ways that the articulation of it might have to do with the ways that people are used to understanding things. You know, a means of communication is dependent on the listener. And so the form of the teachings that we have, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, probably comes from the Ayurvedic, you know, medical condition, the where they diagnosed the disease, and then the cause for the disease, the cure for the disease, and the way to cure it, you know, the freedom from the disease and the cure. And whether or not that's the case, much of the language that we use and that the Buddha used in his time is particular to our own culture or to his culture. And the Awada Patimokkha is a sort of boiling down of some of the pure principles of what a Buddha particularly has to teach. And so it's seen as a very auspicious teaching, and one which you can kind of carry around with you if you are to remember it, as, you know, if you forget what the point is, this is the heart of it. Kanti paramang tapo titika nipanang paramang vadanti buddha. Patient forbearance is the foremost self-discipline. Nibbana is paramount, the Buddhas say. So patient forbearance, patient endurance, kanti, you know, patience. This is not, you know, he's not saying that one particular type of meditation practice is the very supreme and best that we practice. He's saying patience. This is the supreme practice, the supreme self-discipline. And Nibbana, you know, complete extinction of all suffering that we have with our experience. This is the most important thing. And every Buddha will say this. They'll say it in different ways, maybe use different words, different forms of teachings. But this is the direction to go in, Nibbana, And the best, most effective way that we can practice to go there is, well, isn't that interesting? Patience. You know, the supreme austerity, the supreme practice. And patience is probably something each of us can relate to. Whether or not we feel that we have a lot of patience or a little patience, we all know that it's an important thing, because when we start to see our own suffering and how our likes and dislikes and emotions push and pull us around all the time, here and there, you know, it takes patience to be with that. And we can start to see that the way out of reacting angrily when we feel the feelings of anger, if we don't want to just go with those feelings and become angry, we need patience to be able to be with those feelings, not to try to block them out impatiently, try to get rid of the anger. We need to use patience. And that was very much a kind of key part of the training set up for our own community by Ajahn Chah and the forest monasteries in Thailand. Often the situations were kind of deliberately difficult, so that you had to experience irritation and suffering, and you had to learn to be with that. You had to learn patience. You had to learn kanti paramang, patient endurance through it as a means to practice. Very much as perhaps for even Lumpo Cha, perhaps from what I've heard, even more than the time to sit cross-legged and develop samadhi, strong concentration practice. And so, of course, we've all heard the stories of Ajahn Chah making the monks sit there, even when they could be meditating otherwise. And he'd be talking to lay people hour after hour after hour, telling the same story over and over and over again, deliberately, with the monks not being able to move, you know, because it wouldn't be polite. And they only had to sit there on the hard concrete without a cushion, with the cold wind blowing on the bare shoulders. And all they could do if they wanted to move was you had to sit, you know, in this polite posture with one leg behind you and one leg in front of you, very, very erect. It's sort of very macho, the whole Thai forest aesthetic. So everyone's sitting very like a Zen, a good Zen monk. And then if you wanted to move, you make a little Anjali once, and then you can switch from your right leg behind you to your left leg behind you, and then a little Anjali, and that was it. And you knew that the other monks next to you were counting how many times you shifted to see how. Now I'm guessing, because I wasn't there, but I have been through a bit of this myself over the years, and it used to be a little bit more like that here as well. In fact, that's one reason I have bad knees. And but Lumpo Cha knew what he was doing. Ajahn Sumedho said, you know, at first he didn't know any Thai or Lao, the local language, Isan, so he would sit there listening, and he couldn't even understand what Lumpo Cha was saying. And he asked one time to Ajahn Chah, can I, you know, during this time, since I can't understand, can I go back to my kuti and practice meditation, feeling that it would be obvious that that would be more useful, you know, more useful for his practice. And Lumpo Cha said, no. And so he just had to sit there, sometimes 5 hours, 6 hours for these talks, and just sitting there. And it was deliberate. Some of the monks say that some Lumpo Cha would create meaningless work projects sometimes if he felt the monks were getting too attached to their sitting meditation times. Sometimes if the monks wanted to work, he'd do the opposite, make them sit meditation. He said if you were feeling too, you know, if you really didn't like the heat in the hot Ubon hot season, then you should shut yourself into your kuti, close all the windows, and wrap yourself up in blankets. You know, and be with the feeling of hot. Where is the suffering in hot? You know, where really is the suffering? Is it in the physical sensations? Well, find out. You know, are they really so unbearable, the physical sensations? We think it is. We think it's, oh, it's my knee. Oh, no, it's the cold breeze. No, no, it's just, it's so hot, I can't take it. But that's the complaining mind that's reacting to this discomfort. And unless we have patience, kanti paramang, to be able to bear with these things we don't want to bear with, we'll never have a chance to really see what's causing the suffering. This is the great gift of it, is because if we really look, we can start to see it's not necessarily the thing we think it is. It's not necessarily the cold breeze. It's not necessarily the heat. It's not even the person, you know, irritating me by making a noise or something. You know, the noise is just a noise. It's just sound. It's not hurting my eardrum. Even if it was pain, if there's pain in my knee, say, how bad is that really? You know, it's yes, it's an unpleasant sensation, and yet most of the suffering I create out of it is my fear of it. Oh no, I can't allow this. I've got to get away from it. I've got to fix it. My proliferation into the future. If it goes on, I might lose my leg, and I'd be a one-legged monk, and that would be really uncomfortable and inconvenient for everybody. And on and on and on, my brain will create a whole story of suffering. So, kanti paramang, tapo titika, the foremost self-discipline is patience. That's really saying something. The Buddha was summarizing to 1,250 already enlightened disciples. What is the teaching of all the Buddhas, you know? Nahi pappajito parupagati sammano hoti parang vihetayanto. One who harms others is no renunciant. One who mistreats another is not a samana. So renunciate and samana, we don't really use these words much in English. It's like we say one who's gone forth. Or the older texts, the Victorian translations that we have, you know, one who's entered the holy life. It's not necessarily, I mean, it is talking about those who are ordained, those who've committed their lives, like the monks and nuns here. But it's also really, truly in the heart. You know, a true samana, the Buddha said, is someone who's committed to these principles in the heart, a true Brahman. And some of, sometimes use the word Brahman, you know, to the Indians who lived at that time. Brahmins were a priestly caste, and people had a particular idea of what a holy person was. And the Buddha would say, well, a true holy person is one who does not cause harm to others. It's not whether you have the right kind of birth or the right kind of training or the right kind of accoutrements. So for us, that would include robes. You know, we're not true samanas, even if we're wearing the robes as monks or nuns. If our heart is not in the right place. So that's not to get all fearful and judgmental about our behavior, but it's just to point to what is the point of all this for anyone, lay person, nun, monk, anyone. One who harms others is no samana. One who mistreats another is not a samana. And so this is really easy to forget sometimes because we can get so wrapped up, even for those of us who come to the monastery and are very committed to the Buddhist path in our own ways, those of us who are ordained, we can forget that, you know, and think that, no, no, it's really important that so-and-so gets that to the puja on time so that that's there and not in that place, and how can he do that? And so I'm going to really give him a bawling out. You know, because it's important to get things organized. And we can forget, you know, the whole point is to not to respond, whatever the situation, do our best not to respond from a place of anger, not to respond from a place of judgment, to be kind, and to be tolerant, and to keep our hearts open to those with whom we're living, and all beings, not just human beings. Sapa papasa akaranang kusala supasampada satita pariyoda panang etang buddha sasanang ubuddhana sasanang. Refraining from all evil, performing the skillful and good, purifying one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So there it is, right there, the summary. You know, basically, in simple form, you know, holding back from, refraining from all intentional evil, harmful. Akusala means unskillful, that which causes harm. When we know it's going to cause harm, keeping ourselves from that, whether it's through acts, mental acts, verbal acts, physical acts, and then positively performing the skillful and good, doing that which is beneficial, which is skillful, kusala. So this is the practice, isn't it? This is really the essence of it. We have all our different training rules. We have the different ways that we can hear the teachings. We have the wonderful formulation of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Anapanasati training for meditation, all of the various teachings we have. We have idiosyncratic teachings from our own teachers, you know, monks and nuns who've practiced and have their own way of talking about it. From their own hearts, we have many ways, many things that we can learn from. And in the end, it all comes down to this, you know, what helps us see what is kusala, skillful, and what is akusala, and then be aware of that so that we can refrain from committing the akusala, the unskillful, and that we can actually cultivate and intentionally do the skillful because of what the effect then is purifying then one's mind. And that, of course, is very much about bringing satisampajanya, awareness, you know, and awareness to the right things into our lives as a practice so that we see what's happening. We can easily have an idea of the practice as trying to make ourselves into the practitioner that we think we need to be. I need to be better, so I will make myself better. And it's an understandable thing to think that way to think and practice, but it's unfortunate because it misses the fact that if we're judging ourselves as we are and saying that we have to become something else, then right there we're off, right at the beginning of it. We have to come from a point where we see that, you know, this is to be accepted just as it is, myself, the world, right now, this moment. My task is not to change it into something else. My task is to be with it with awareness and avoid any movement into the unskillful and incline towards any movement into the skillful. You know, to just stay on that sort of point of, you know, forget about the judging others, judging myself. Just now, what is the skillful? Where is the skillful action here? And where is the unskillful? Trying to avoid the unskillful, trying to move into the skillful. Not because we want to make ourselves into a different person, but because we see that that's the way that the mind inclines to peace and becomes purified. Beneficial for us, beneficial for others. Anupavado anupagato patimokke ca sangvaro. Not to disparage, not to harm, restraint in line with the code of training. Matanyuta ca battasaming patancha sayanasanang. Moderation in food, dwelling secluded. Adichitte cha ayogo etang buddha nasasananti. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So not to use our speech in ways that diminish others, which could hurt others, whether to their face or behind their back. Not to harm others, certainly not physically through our actions, not verbally. And as much as possible, not mentally, really watching our minds with where we go, with how we think about others. Because the mouth and the body follow the mind. And we can worry about this because you can have some terrible thoughts about people and ourselves sometimes. And so again, it's not to suddenly try to become somebody who thinks differently, but it's just to be quite aware of our own minds in a way where we're trying to keep track of not going along with that which is unskillful. So if I'm having unskillful thoughts arise, how can so-and-so do such and such a thing? Well, whatever it is, you know, it's not that you have to stop that thought from coming up. It's there. It's right now. How can I be with that thought? It's a phenomenon happening right now in a way where I'm not believing in it. I'm not going with it. I'm not convinced by it. I'm not acting from it. Right there, you've moved away from the unskillful, and that action itself is a skillful action. It can be, we can work with ways of making it more positively skillful by saying something deliberately kind to somebody we're having difficulty with. You know, giving a gift to someone we're angry with, not to be false or to try to sort of make ourselves different, but that can give us a mirror that to our own underlying emotions, which can otherwise be very hard to see. But just awareness can be enough, and not to disparage, not to harm, restraint, in line with the training that we have. You know, we each have a different training. The nuns have their training, the monks have our training, the lay people, you have your training. If you wish, you have for this evening, those of you who have taken it, the 8 precepts. You can bring more or less into your lives as lay people. That's your prerogative. We're much more limited, the monks and nuns, and that's one of the points. And so that's why you often hear these teachings in terms of negative phrases. You know, not to do this, not to do that, to refrain from this and stop doing that, rather than positive phrases of trying to do this and trying to build that and becoming this and becoming that. And that's because we have within us already a purity, you could say. You know, that there's it's kind of the good news of Buddhism, which is that we're not creating in a sense. You know, we're not essentially bad people who have to become good by adding things. It's that all of us are essentially peaceful and pure, that Nibbana is a potential for every living being. And yet, because of our ignorance, we're obstructing it all the time, in every moment, in one way or another. And so we're getting in the way of our own peace and happiness, as well as others. So the teachings are often given in terms of to stop doing this and to stop doing that, because really, if we just stop obstructing the peaceful heart, we'll be able to see the peace that's already there. You know, the mind, that's why meditation, isn't it? It's not much, you're not doing anything, we're not adding anything in. There's nothing wrong with doing positive actions. In fact, they're very skillful sometimes, but it's one reason why I think that we don't have more, say, like bhajan chanting in Theravada Buddhist monasteries. You know, there's wonderful feelings and inspiring emotions that can be generated and stirred up through, say, music and chanting. And it's not to judge that and say it's wrong, but it's to say that even better, from our perspective, that silence, just stopping, gives this opportunity for the heart to become seen for what it is, and thereby slowly purified. So there's not much on the surface often in the Buddhist practice. It's quite deliberately boring and staid, and just there's this, and yes, we can do that, and very everyday activities. Just go to the meal, and the cultures that Buddhism has grown up in has added little colorful things. So we have our candlelight circumambulation of something yet to be determined this evening, either the courtyard or the stupa, and that is a wonderful and beautiful thing that we will do. You know, a kind of ritual together, and it has an effect. Is it necessary? No. Is it helpful? Well, yes. In its time and in its place, it's come to us through tradition, and so we do it. Things like the meal. Well, the whole business of I'm sitting up here in a particular seat. I do a little chant. I bow to the senior monk first if I'm going to come up here. You know, all of it is very ritualized, and we've inherited these things through traditions. Are they necessary? No. Do they help? Well, yes, if we pick them up in the right way, they can. All the mealtime traditions. I'm always surprised now these last few weeks with Ajahn Amaro taking his personal retreat, and I've been sitting in this sort of the front seat and talking to people after the meal. And I never knew how many people come to the monastery really wanting the water to be sprinkled upon them. I always thought it was one or two, you know, here and there. And but that, you know, I'm almost out of water now. We're going to have to do some parittas with the candles and everything with some water to refill that little brass jug. So, but it's, you know, and so I'll always give a little preamble, because it's my nature to do that, about how this is not magic water. And in fact, the Buddha told us not to make magic water. But you can use it, if you wish, as a symbol for what is good and pure and help you remember. Same with the little strings that we tie. The Thai people tend to like the water. And the Sri Lankan people tend to like the strings on the wrists, but they all like each one. And the Westerners, too. At first, the Westerners, you know, were always, especially in America, and probably here, too, you know, oh, all these rituals, I guess I can go along with a little bit of it, and I don't think I'll bow. But then after a few weeks, maybe, okay, I can bow, I get the point. And a little bit slowly into it. And then after a while, after a few years, especially the ones who've been around 10, 20 years, having kids, wanting something to bring the family into it, they love all of this thing, the blessings, and come and give me a house blessing, and bless the baby, and the little strings. And so you can see how it can have a skillful effect if we choose to use these things consciously. But the essence is the pure mind. We don't need any of it, but we do need to avoid from intentionally acting by body or speech or mind in ways that are harmful for ourselves or others. And we need to incline towards the intentional actions which are skillful. So we have all these wonderful opportunities to do skillful things, like give gifts and decorate shrines in beautiful ways that will inspire people. And it's like an economy of giving at the monastery, not because people from outside who don't understand these principles, it can really seem like good deal for you guys, you know, the monks and the nuns there, an economy of giving. You just sit there and you live your lives, and people come and they give you all these things, and that's how it was. I remember many of you have seen the BBC documentary, The Buddha Comes to Sussex, where the monks first came to the little village of Chithurst in West Sussex. And it was just at the time when Ajahn Chah was visiting, and they just moved into the house. And they actually filmed one of these local council meetings where the monks were introducing themselves and trying to allay the fears of the local community. And there were people who stood up and quite vocally wondered about them, including one man who said, you know, all right, you know, I'd say, you know, what did he say? He said, I think, you know, if you can get something for nothing, good on you, you know, or something like that. People don't realize that there's a giving on all sides in this economy of giving, but the opportunity it gives you is to be in an atmosphere which encourages skillful action. It encourages us, so keeping the precepts, we're encouraged to remember the value of truthful and kind, sensitive speech, not deceptive or abusive speech or insensitive, dismissive speech. Kind actions which help others, and to watch our own thoughts in a way where we can start to see the patterns in our minds maybe we didn't see before. And so if you're like me, when I came, and it really was quite a wake-up call, because I had an idealistic vision of what a spiritual person I was. And then just to see how my mind got so petty and you know, jealous, and it was humiliating. And yet probably all of us, if we've practiced a little bit, have seen this. And being in a context of a monastery like this helps us to see that. So this is why you often have, you know, refraining from, not doing, so that you take away the clutter. You're not adding in more stuff. You want to see what's there already, because the heart itself is already pure. Like if we're stirring up the water in a pond, and so you can't see because it's so muddy, you can't see through. And we keep stirring the water, we'll never see through the clear. It'll seem like it's just simply muddy water, and that's all we are, is just opaque, muddy water. If we stop, just stop making waves for long enough, it might take a long, long time. Gradually, we see the water itself actually isn't opaque. It's not cloudy. There are particles in there, and with us stopping the stirring up, they'll have time to just settle along with the currents down to the bottom. And oh, isn't that something? The mind is already clear. It's already peaceful. We start to see how we make ourselves suffer through our intentional actions of akusala actions, all from the extreme of cruel actions to even subtle ones, like ones where we're just indulging in other kilesas, the forces in all the various forms of greed, hatred, delusion, the lobha, dosa, and moha, or basic forces of I want, or I don't want, and not seeing what's happening. And this is why the fifth precept's in there. You know, it's not that drinking or taking drugs is immoral per se, but it's certainly akusala, unskillful, in the sense that it has a harmful effect. It keeps stirring the water where we cannot see truly what's going on, and we tend to fall into the unskillful intentional acts. Dwelling secluded. This is something that we often think of only in the literal sense, and so especially when you're a monk or a nun, you can think, oh, cough, all this busyness at Amaravati. You know, the Buddha said we should dwell secluded, and that must mean, you know, a hut on my own in the jungle somewhere, or a cave in Kauai, or a cave up on the top of the Himalayas, or whatever our particular image is. You know, and so we think, oh my goodness, that's what we're supposed to be doing. You look, the Buddha said in his summary, right there, Pattancha Sayanasanang. Dwelling secluded. Well, dwelling secluded, what does it really mean? Yes, it does mean also dwelling physically secluded from all the motion of the whole, you know, world. And so it does mean to an extent getting out of the usual swing of life in the way that people are living their lives, most people. And so coming to a monastery is a way of living secluded, in a sense, secluded from the worldly ways of the world. We have a different environment here. You know, it can mean also physically living secluded in the way that we think of it as well, in a kuti, quietly, on our own. We all, for this retreat, have a chance, whether we're in a building, in a room, or in a kuti like I am, we have a chance to live more secluded from each other and from the communal duties and relationships than we usually do, and we can use this. But Lumpo Liam and Lumpo Cha, I believe, and many of the good teachers I've ever known, when they're asked about living secluded by monks who want to go off on their own, they always talk about living secluded is living secluded in the heart. Whether you're with people, whether you're not with people, if you're secluded in that sense, it's what you're doing in your mind when you're with people. So there is a point which we start to come to in practice where we become more familiar with our own mind. You know, in the end, it's not ours. It's not my own mind. So it's just the mind. In a way where... it's something we can rely on, and the kind of seclusion that it can then provide is one which is not dependent on the outer conditions. So even when we're with other people, if we're truly mindful in a deep way, There's a kind of seclusion there, an inner seclusion, which is one which is, that's what's pointed to and hoped, you know, that's what we're encouraged to reach through whatever physical seclusion we might use in our practice. You know, whether it's we have the opportunity to do that a lot or a little at the beginning or as we grow in our practice, whether we never have that opportunity at all. It's pointing towards, it doesn't matter if we're secluded. We can live in a hut and we can spend, you know, 5 years in a hut just rehashing the old arguments we had with our brother, you know, 16 years ago, and then your mother when you were 4 or 5, and then your boss when you were leaving to become a nun or a monk or whatever it is. You can do that quite easily. I've spent lots of time in little huts and places doing all kinds of things that I'm almost embarrassed to remember, because it's very easy. You know, when you're alone, you can end up sort of babbling away to yourself with all these things inside your mind. And you realize, oh my goodness, I'm still carrying all this around. I'm still living with all these people. I'm not secluded, right? And you go back into community life, and it's really up to you how much you're carrying people around, even when people are with, when you're living and talking with people and working with people. So the seclusion that our teachers have pointed to in this tradition has the true seclusion has been that kind of seclusion of the mind, of the heart. And so that for that Amaravati, I feel it's perfect. And we really do have a good balance here. This very rare opportunity like now, the 3-month winter retreat, these opportunities we have for self-retreats, the times when we really have to be together, you know, in all kinds of ways which are very busy. Even by worldly standards, sometimes we can be quite busy because we don't clock off at 5 o'clock in the evening and have weekends and vacations. And so we really have to learn how to manage all this, and it can be difficult at Amaravati. I know. I have a trouble managing it sometimes. And yet, okay, there's the managing of it, but can we stay? The priority is to stay with that kind of mindfulness, which means that we don't forget ourselves. You know, if it's peaceful, we know it's peaceful. If it's busy, we know it's busy. If it's feeling good, we know it's feeling good. If it's feeling bad, we know it's feeling bad. And that knowing is so easy to dismiss as just, oh yeah, okay, so what? But that's really the key, I'd say. You just know what's happening now and know what's happening now and keeping it in the moment. There's a certain kind of seclusion that can then develop, which allows us to be in situations where there's a lot of pressure. We still might feel a lot of stress because it's natural to feel stress in the situation we might be in, given our conditioning and our emotional makeup and everything. But it's possible to be with the feeling of stress in a way which we're not being stressful with it, you know. So we feel stress, yes, but as a feeling, just like feeling the pain in my knee or the cold shoulder or the hot, you know, in the kuti. Yes, but where is the suffering? This is stressful. My life is busy. But where really is the suffering in that? So using patient endurance, kanti paranang, with that, you know, with my experience of life, wherever the suffering is, where is the suffering? Asking this question. You know, my life is too busy. My life is too peaceful. My life has too many people in it. My life is too solitary. My life is too hot, too cold, too this, too that. All of us have a little bit of a two in there, a worm in the apple. You know, there's always a little worm in the apple. And it's not to judge any of it. You know, it's a good thing if we see this. It's an opportunity, the Buddha said, to purify our minds by being patient with it, and that way seeing where the root of the suffering is. Not in the sensation itself, the sensation of heat or cold or stress, but in the sensation of, you know, in the response to, in the reaction to that sensation. That we always have a choice in every moment, you know, to let go and be with, to be still, to refrain from reacting and becoming, you know, our personality right in this moment. We'll still operate, we'll still we'll speak and we'll feel just the same way, and yet if we stay with the knowing, we can slowly, slowly let it go. Stop being so much of ourself in our life, living more and more secluded, purifying our minds. Adichite cha ayogo etang buddhana sasananti, commitment to the heightened mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. And that heightened mind, then, rather than some kind of idea of a super duper duper enlightened mind that we can, you know, make ourselves into, with all ideas of blissful feelings and psychic powers and whatever we might think of, it can be very, very ordinary seeming. You know, the heightened mind being the still water, the pure consciousness that starts to become clear as we practice, that is heightened even in the presence of very ordinary experience. Nothing special, just this. You know, and now just this. So tonight, we can I asked Ajahn Amaro because I couldn't remember what happened. I tend not to remember what happens at these things. And he said he thought that when he gave a talk last time, we all chanted through the Pali verse by verse of this wonderful Owada Patimokkha. The Pali rather than the English, because the English doesn't really have a nice tune to it. And so if we can do that now, that's one reason the lights are still up. And it's something many people are doing around the world today in different Buddhist communities. So we'll start with, we'll do it verse by verse, and we'll just do our best as a way of ending this talk. Kanti paramang tapo titika nibbanang paramang vadanti buddha nahija papajito parupagati sammano hoti parang vihetayanto sabbapapa sakkaranang kusala supa Sampada Sachita Pariyo Dapanang Etang Buddhana Sasanang Anupavado Anupagato Patimokhe Chasangwaro Matanyuta Chapasaming Patan Chasayanasanang Adichite chayogo etang buddhana sasanante. Ewan. So what I would suggest, I think this evening we can leave the hall open for everyone until midnight. Anyone who'd like to stay for that is welcome. But you're not required to stay until midnight, but you're invited and everyone to partake in the circumambulation now. And so there's a verse we usually chant beforehand, which I can lead and you can follow. I'll do it in short little sentences. I learned my lesson at the meal yesterday. And maybe before we do that, but before you start lighting candles, I think we'll give everybody a few minutes to, if you need to have a loo break or bundle up in some warm clothes. So it's now 9:35. If we gather back here in 10 minutes, at 9:45, we try to do that, and then we can start from there. Mm-hmm.